let's just bow our heads and pray. May your steadfast love, O Lord, be upon us, even as our hope is in you. Amen. Before I begin, I have to make an apology. An illustration in this sermon is a little song that I remember from Sunday school and teaching kids over the years, and the chorus I thought was fairly appropriate as part of an illustration in the sermon, and I decided that I'd sing it. So I apologise for the singing right now, for when I hit the wrong notes and get the beat wrong and all that sort of stuff. Not only did I was unable to learn the guitar, I don't have the confidence that much to sing solo. So I apologise for that first. With that over and done with, you probably realise if you've come every Sunday that we're reading through the Gospel of Luke this year. And just as an aside, the lectionary that we use, the Revised Common Lectionary, every 3 years we read through Mark, Matthew and Luke, and smattered in those 3 years we read through parts of John, especially around Easter and Christmas or other times. So, we're continuing to read through Luke, who tells us in the beginning of his gospel what his aim is, his purpose. He uses these words: "Since I have myself carefully investigated everything from the beginning, I too decided to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, so that you may know the certainty of the things you have been taught." An orderly account here does not mean ordered chronologically. It means ordered in a way that proves the things you have been taught about Jesus. So Luke's book is about proving to you the things that you have been taught and that they are true. Our passage starts with the words, "Now large crowds were travelling with him, and he turned and said to them." On several occasions in Luke's gospel, Jesus is with large crowds, and Luke introduces some of Jesus' teaching with this sentence, "He turned and said to them." So far, over the last few weeks, we've been travelling through chapters 13 and 14, and Luke has placed together in these chapters stories of Jesus' discussion and actions on the Sabbath. We had a few weeks ago the woman in the synagogue who was bent over, healed by Jesus, and the discussion about what was right to do and good to do on the Sabbath, or just versus following the rules. We are told that Jesus is on a journey and on his way to Jerusalem, and there is another opportunity for Jesus to teach about taking the narrow road and the difficulty of being saved. He's warned by the Pharisees, Herod was trying to kill him. His reply again, teaching, and you'll get the reference in this if you think of the resurrection and the 3 days in the tomb and so forth. "I am performing cures today and tomorrow, and on the third day I finish my work." Then comes a healing of a man with dropsy, and I always thought dropsy meant a disease where you were always falling down, dropsy, you know. But it comes from a Greek word which means water. And it's actually a disease where you carry too much fluid. So this man had dropsy and Jesus heals him. And then he goes to a dinner with the Pharisee in a Pharisee's house on the Sabbath day. And he teaches about the choice of to behave with humility, respect, kindness and hospitality rather than self-promotion. You know, the story about he watches the crowd and people coming up and taking the high seats, and he says, well, no, you should take the low seats so that you can be honoured by being brought up higher. Most Anglicans know that. They sit at the back of the church. Well, not a very Anglican congregation, this, because you're all there in the front. But that's okay. That's okay. So, a comment by a guest at a feast is another opportunity to teach with a parable of the wedding feast. You know, the story about the king who's having a feast, and he goes and invites all this crowd, and everyone says, no, no, I've got to do this, I've got to do that, I can't come. And so in the end, he says to the servants, go out and invite everybody in the streets, the poor, the crippled, the blind, the lame, so that his hall is filled with guests. And here comes the singing. There's a little song about that, and it describes the parable in the verses, but the chorus is the reply of the people who can't come. And it goes like this. I cannot come, I cannot come, I cannot come to the banquet, don't trouble me now. I have married me a wife, I have bought me a cow, of fields and commitments that cost a plenty sum. Pray hold me excused, I cannot come. Thank you. I've got a real fan over here, he claps every time.
He wants you to come back there. Fruity, fruity.
Yeah. I'll let you two sort that one out later. Yeah, so this idea of, you know, putting all these commitments and everything before, you know, taking up the invitation of Jesus to come to the banquet, to be part of the banquet in heaven. That's what that's about. So do you see the picture that Luke is building of Jesus as Luke goes about his aim, so that you may know the certainty of the things that you have been taught, the healings that Jesus performed, the wisdom in his teaching, and the way that Jesus is reframing our understanding of God. Now large crowds were travelling with Jesus, and he turned and said to them, we're up to our reading now. Whoever comes to me and does not hate father, mother, wife and children, and brothers and sisters, yes, even life itself, cannot be my disciple. And just hold that for a minute. What did Jesus say? Hate father, mother, wife, children? That goes against the grain, doesn't it? Especially when we remember Jesus' teaching. It's hard to reconcile with against Jesus' teaching, who quotes from the law of Leviticus to love our neighbour as ourself. In fact, he goes further with that and says that we are to love our enemies and to do good to them. If we are to love in this radical way of loving our neighbour, which Jesus extends to mean love our enemies, then it must not exclude loving our mother, our father, our brother, our sister, our children, our nearest and dearest, surely. And I really don't know how to reconcile that word hate. I've heard some things that helped me. One was that sometimes in being a disciple of Jesus, we will be separated from our families. And sometimes our families will be against us being Christians and try to change us. But hate them? Jesus said, love our enemies. I'm not sure about that. Another example of reconciling this word hate was that Jesus often uses very provocative language to grab attention. It's what's called in English exaggeration for the purpose of emphasis. Maybe he's using that word hate to really get us listening. And then goes on with the basic teaching that he wants us to hear. He actually says at the end, if you have ears, hear. Our reading continues with more about this teaching. Whoever does not carry the cross and follow me cannot be my disciple. It's the second time he said that. Now, if we've been reading Luke in one go, right from the beginning up to here, we would realise that we've already read this bit. Back in chapter 9, he says this, and he said to all, if any man would come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross daily and follow me. For whoever would save his life will lose it, and whoever loses his life for my sake will save it. For what does it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses or forfeits himself? For whoever is ashamed of me and of my words, of him will the Son of Man be ashamed when he comes in his glory and the glory of the Father and of the holy angels. Is this another way of saying, if you want to be a follower of Jesus, you must consider it very carefully, for you cannot be a half-hearted believer? Well, guess what? That's exactly what Jesus says in the next bit. He tells two little stories. Jesus asks a first question through this parable. When you are building, do you not first count the cost before you start so that you will know whether you are able to finish, he says. To put this in emotional and moral terms, do you have the moral fibre for to be a wholehearted, authentic Christian? Can you afford to follow? The second parable or story is about the king who has to decide what to do. If his 10,000 men can defeat an army of 20,000, the wise king does not just wait around for defeat in this impossible situation. He immediately asks for terms for peace. In emotional and moral terms, reckon whether you can afford to refuse Jesus' demands. The two little parables look at this question of discipleship from two different angles. First, can I afford to follow? And secondly, can I afford not to follow? In the New Testament scholar, the Reverend Canon Leon Morris sums this passage up in this way. The lesson is plain. Jesus does not want followers to rush into discipleship without thinking of what it involves. And he is clear about the price. Anyone who comes to him must renounce all that he or she has. For the third time, we have the refrain, cannot be my disciple. These words condemn half-heartedness. Jesus is not, of course, discouraging discipleship. He is warning against an ill-considered, faint-hearted attachment, in order that those who follow him may know the real thing. He wants them to count the cost and reckon all lost for his sake, so that they can enter the exhilaration of full-blooded discipleship. For what does it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses or forfeits himself. In the name of the Father and of the Son.